Welcome to another episode of Our Interesting Times. My guest this evening is Jay Dyer. Jay, how you doing?
Doing great, Tim. How are you?
Great. Thanks for coming back on the show so soon.
Sure.
Listen, one thing, of course, you are the host of Jay's Analysis, jaysanalysis.com, mm-hmm. and the author of Esoteric Hollywood, Sex, Cults, and Symbols in Film, a book I highly recommend. I've read and enjoyed greatly.
Thank you.
And, of course, you can get that book either directly from the publisher, Amazon, but you really should get it from Jay Dyer directly because he will send you a signed copy and it helps support his work.
Yes, absolutely.
So I recommend doing that, and you will get a signed, nice, good, solid copy of this thing in your hand. So I recommend that. So, Jay, you penned a very interesting article last week, and I think it's worthy of some further examination and elucidation, because you cover it's it wasn't a very long article, but it covered a lot. It covered the Trump presidency and the whole Enlightenment project, and what he mean. He's turning postmodernism against itself, which I thought was a rather interesting concept. I probably need to explain that better. But you the article is why. Well, where's that title here? My notes here. Why I'm finally converted to pro Trump. So you're pro Trump now, of course. Well, go ahead. What's your impressions of the Trump administration, which is, less than 2 weeks old, 2 weeks now?
I'm impressed. I didn't expect it to go this way. And, yeah, the title, I mean, obviously I'm not meaning it in a literal religious sense. The people that were on the alt-right that were trolling for Trump and all that, that was kind of a satirical kind of meme and that kind of stuff. So I said, I think back, around the time of October, November, when I was on with Henrik and Red Ice, I said I was optimistic and I had a hopeful approach to Trump and that he would at least possibly be something better. But we just had so many years, Quigley talks about a century of politicians that were controlled by special interests, by banks and all that, and CFR and this kind of stuff. So we've never really seen a person who was really that independent, and I mean, maybe arguments could be made that when presidents kind of stepped out of line, they got put back in line, whatever your view of Reagan or JFK or Nixon or any of their scandals could have been the result of, or their death perhaps could have been the result of going out of step with the CIA and the CFR and all that. So we haven't seen anything like this, but I've tended to be pretty cynical, and probably a lot of that was the result of 8 years of Obama and Bush and the Clintons. And it just seemed like business as usual, and that was my expectation, but I still didn't want to be totally cynical. Then Trump amazingly won the election, which nobody expected, and I had one friend who said a year ago that this was going to happen. The only other person was Ann Coulter, so the whole world was wrong except for like two people. Maybe Alex Jones could be classed in that group too. And I think that the reason they were right was that they saw the anger that was welling up amongst a lot of America. As we talked about with Patrick on one of the Sunday Wires, I think East Coast and West Coast elites in LA and New York, they're just so out of touch with the rest of the country. They don't realize that they don't represent the rest of the country. And we don't live in a world where, in a country where everybody's represented by LA and New York. You know what I mean? That's not America. America is more properly a bunch of different little countries. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So this, the South is very different from the North. So
that's how it's supposed to be. Yes.
Well, yeah, right. Yeah. I'm just saying in terms of culture,
mm-hmm.
If the South even still is very different from the Yankee North.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't, these people are just totally out of touch with this, with the reality of what people in the Midwest and the South and all this that they go through. So I think that Ann Coulter and Alex Jones and my friend, they had a better sense of the pulse of the rest of the country. And so I think that's probably why they were right about it. And there's been so much deception in the media, so much bold-faced lying, and they got caught so readily, blatantly doing it, that I think that we really did start to see fissures and cracks in the establishment. So now, does that mean that Trump is right about everything, or that I have to agree with everything that he believes and says? No. But I think that already within the first couple weeks, we begin to see that a lot of the things that he promised, he did intend to do. And that has just, we've just never seen this with a candidate. It's just, I think it's pretty spectacular. It may not be everything that everybody wants, or the degree to which we might want. But it just seemed to, the point, I think, where I finally was convinced was when I went and just actually looked at what all the think tanks were saying. And so when you scroll through what Brookings Institute, what the ISS, Institute for Strategic Studies, what the CFR, what the Atlantic Council, all these different globalist entities, and every one of them is just anti-Trump, going crazy, and basically threatening the end of the world, that I think was a really strong indicator for me that even if he's got, like, totally selfish motives, they don't want it. And I finally, I think, realized that it just became less plausible to believe that it's all a giant ruse than to believe Occam's razor, right? That the simplest explanation is that he legitimately represents something outside of the normal special interest lobbying power structure. I think it's that simple. And you might say, well, but you've argued, Jay, that America itself is kind of ridiculous, and I think it is. But that's where the whole postmodern element comes in, is that Trump, I think, from his experience in both business and Hollywood pop culture, he understands how the culture works and how it's all entertainment driven. And so he is a kind of joke president. He's a kind of anti-hero president, perhaps. And that's what we mean by the postmodern president. So to understand postmodernism, you have to understand the idea of the breakdowns of Enlightenment philosophies. So the Enlightenment taught the, just broadly speaking, painting the brush broadly here, the Enlightenment gave us the idea that governments could be organized in a purely reasonable, rational fashion, in a sort of democratic republic style, the Masonic idea, all this coming out of the Enlightenment, the French Revolution and all this stuff, scientific revolution, things that we've talked about in the past. And the structures of power that developed as a result of this have been largely failures, right? I mean, the 20th century has given us tremendous amounts of war. We know, you and I, of course, and people that have looked into Tragedy and Hope and Anthony Sutton, we know that these front pieces of democratic republics are controlled by moneyed oligarchs. They don't really represent what they pretend to represent. And so I would argue that the only way that you could potentially have any sort of player coming onto the scene who represents an alternative idea or represents a threat to the establishment would be somebody who is independently wealthy. Now, I don't really think Ross Perot was, he seemed like he was genuinely against NAFTA and stuff like that when he was debating Al Gore, But I mean, Ross Perot had no charisma. He didn't understand pop culture and how to be a showman. And I think that's obviously the success of Trump, is that he's also a comedian. He's very funny, and he just doesn't care And I don't think that it's all an act. And I think that to be convinced that it's all an act is itself a kind of demoralizing effect. And I've been thinking about this a lot lately. Like, if you think about Orwell's 1984, the end of the book is totally hopeless. You know, you've got a boot stamping on your face for all eternity. And I don't know what Eric Blair's intentions were. Maybe he was secretly a good guy. People tell these stories of him going to live in a, you know, out in the middle of nowhere in Scotland or something. He was always afraid that British intelligence was going to come and murder him or something. I don't know if that's true, but what I do know is that I've been thinking about the possibility of 1984 itself being a demoralizing psyop, because if you read 1984 or Brave New World, they leave you with no hope. They give you the impression that there's just no way. You can't oppose it. You can't stop globalism. And, you know, that's a big part of psyops, is to demoralize the enemy. You know, that's just kind of obvious, right? Like, demoralize them and then you've won. They don't
Well,
have,
yeah.
they've lost morale. And so, and I'm not
Despair.
saying that, yeah, exactly. Now, I'm not saying that I believe that in Trump as some sort of savior, but I think that the legitimate traditional right-wing thought can ride that wave of hope and of optimism, and that the future actually does present different possibilities, that we don't have to be locked into the cynicism and the demoralized state that the establishment would have us to be in. And a lot of it was built on fear. A lot of it was built on, you know, oh, if you say the wrong thing, you're going to lose your job. But I think the left has overplayed their hand in their tactics in that regard, because people are starting to realize that it's actually getting insane. You know what I mean? They're going to come after your kids. They're going to make your kids. They're going to try to get your kids into transgenderism. People are figuring this out. They're not going to want that for their kids. You know, they're going to. If you go hear Milo talk, if you go hear Gavin McInnes talk, you might get beat up and attacked. And I just think that people are, these actions are, they've overstepped. And so, you know, Trump represents a reaction against that. Brexit represents that. And, you know, they just keep saying the left, the cynical left, the anti-war left, and the establishment left just hammer all day long that you just can't stop any of this. You'll never stop any of this. You have nothing. And what do we see? We see Le Pen, the European right. We see these things growing. I don't think that nationalism in itself is any kind of magical cure. I think that we're gonna have to see people looking back to God, to religion, to these things for their foundations. That's my view, at least. And I think Trump represents just a kind of general movement in that direction. He's a symbol for that kind of stuff. And that's really what I was getting in the piece.
Yes. Now, a couple points you made. Talk about Trump's attempt to bringing jobs back to the country. Now, there was a time when a politician spoke in those terms, the right libertarian would say that cry protectionism. And the problem with that critique is they're not seeing the whole picture. When you look, talk, you know, good example of during the campaign, he went up to was it Indiana or Wisconsin, the Carrier factory for air conditioners. And they were shipping their, shut down the factory and ship it down to Mexico for cheaper labor. And apparently he's talked to the Carrier and they're not doing that anymore. And they're not going to do that and the jobs are going to stay up there. You have to ask yourself, why is there so much cheap labor in Mexico? And what has happened and what has been going on in Mexico and around the world has allowed for this deindustrialization, outsourcing that has stripped the United States of its industrial capacity. And also led to the, I think, rising debt and the decline of the middle class. This goes back to, I think, to deindustrialization is all part of Rockefeller, trilateralism, Bretton Woods, interdependency, and globalism. And
Absolutely.
when
Totally.
so there's all this internationalism. It's just presumed that that's the sophisticated, that's the modern, that's the future, internationalism, interventionism, internationalism. And when he's one thing, he also spoke of America First, not only in the campaign, but also in his in his inaugural address. This is sort of a return to the 1920s normalcy, which has also been, I think, unfairly condemned by court historians as America's descent in isolationism, which led to Hitler, despite the fact it was America's intervention in World War I, which led to the rise of Hitler. But you don't want to go back, you know, we never go back more than a few years to understand history.
And why did it take all those British intelligence agents to convince Americans to come into the war?
Yes. and this, yes, goes back to when he spoke of American first. People who are keen to history immediately think of Charles Lindbergh and his speech on September 11th, by the way, 1941, in Des Moines, Iowa, where he goes back and Charles Lindbergh says, quote, he's speaking against intervention into the war, and he goes, Charles Lindbergh said, the three most important groups who have been pressing this country toward war are the British, the Jewish, and the Roosevelt administration. Behind these groups are, but of lesser importance, are a number of capitalist, Anglophiles, intellectuals who believe that the future of mankind depends upon the domination of the British Empire. Add to these the communistic groups which were opposed to intervention until a few weeks ago, and I believe I have named the major war agitators in this country. Now, he's pretty much, he's hitting right narrow right on the head there about who's dragging the country into the war, which is why he was then slandered and after giving that speech.
Well, isn't it interesting that Quigley says in Tragedy and Hope that this was the only legitimate American opposition to globalism?
Yes, and that, you know, Quigley admits that Lindbergh was right, and he was right. So this is sort of this opposition to this Midwestern, Middle America opposition to empire and interventionism, and return to maybe a more industrial, agrarian economy, you know, the combination of the two that are productive and away from this sort of this West Coast, you know, East Coast financialization and of the global economy, which is kind of this whole City of London deal.
You know? Yeah, absolutely.
But
yes, and that's what I finally figured out was that, you know, I think obviously Trump's not Hitler. That's the stupidest thing ever. But the America First idea is a reference to what it says, America first. We're not interested in these problems over there first and foremost. And I think that what globalism has always tried to do, and for example, the reason that it's so successful amongst, say, college age or young people, is that, you got to be concerned about the being anti-war and something that's happening, you know, thousands of miles away over there somewhere.
Darfur.
Yeah,
Tibet.
Or Kony 2012.
Yeah.
But the absurdity of this is that, like, you're not even concerned about the people in your hometown. Like, there's homeless people, poor people, perhaps, in your hometown, but you're going to have this virtue signaling, faux righteousness about some conflict, you know, thousands of miles away that you know nothing about. So that's just ludicrous.
Which may or may not be happening.
Exactly. It might be totally fake. Like Kony.
Yeah.
But it's sold to you as a way to maybe soothe your ego and your conscience into feeling like you're liberal and that you're helping the earth or some baloney like this. Now, that as you see, that can be a mean. Now, I'm not saying that Vietnam and, you know, the places where that technique was pushed upon students and the student riots and all this kind of stuff in the 60s. I'm not saying that means that the Vietnam was good and legitimate. I'm not saying that, but I'm saying that you can see how that could be a means of getting people to think that they're anti-establishment, you know, and they don't even have any care or concern for the people around them. So it's a very hypocritical approach to these questions, and it promotes globalism, and it promotes the idea that you're, you know, going to fix these conflicts by some, you know, pseudo activism for something in, as you said, Darfur or Kony 2012 or whatever. And those are all just, of course, covers for, you know, AFRICOM or foreign policy ventures and so forth and so on. So anyway, I don't think that it's necessary to overthink some of these things when the simplest explanation would be that all these global think tanks are going after him because they don't like him.
Yeah, I think in the boiler room, I don't know if you have it at your disposal now at your fingertips, but CFR, Brookings, literally contradicting themselves within the same paragraph about what Trump, represents or what the threat he represents.
Yeah, that was a great CFR paper. That if Trump kept Americans safe, I've already forgotten how it's worded, but it's something like that. Like, even if Trump prevents terror attacks, it's not keeping Americans safe. Now, I'm not saying that the war on terror is great or that it's all real, but it's not, because we've been critiquing it for a long time. It's a strategy. But it's funny because we have this attitude of the people at the CFR and the Brookings Institute that oh, they're these great intellectuals and they're these great geniuses, and they can't even write a sentence without contradicting themselves because they're so enmeshed in their propaganda that they got at their Ivy League institutions. But I don't really think that means very much either, because I remember a couple of years ago reading a study that was done that something like 70% of the graduating class of Harvard completely believes everything about climate change. So that says to me that the Harvard grads are not that bright. So yes, it's very it was very enlightening this week to now I've perused think tank papers here and there, but I kind of got in this habit of, when I was banned from Facebook, trolling and harassing some of the think tanks on Twitter, and responding to their very dumbed down, stupid articles and the article titles, which are like Chatham House saying that all identity is evil, like in terms of we can never have identity and politics mixed together. To which I said, "So does that mean Chatham House completely rejects the state of Israel?" There were many, there was a whole bunch of these, right? Like that I was just having fun on Twitter, and you can really go to town with this kind of stuff and have fun with it. But most people will do this with like CNN and all that kind of stuff, and there's some really, really genius stuff on Twitter. People, harassing and trolling CNN, which I like to see. But I just think that it's great that Trump's going to sit up there and say fake CNN's fake news. I was reading his Twitter feed last week, and it was just all he was just constantly calling NBC fake news, fake news, fake news. So that's what we mean by the postmodern, trolling aspect of stuff. It's like it doesn't. I think that the key point that I'm trying to get at here is just that these overlords that we have all this fear and project all this power onto, they're not that powerful. Now, they have money, they have the foundations, they have the media, but they don't really, they're not that clever. I'm talking about the mouthpieces, right? I'm not talking about the, the generals and the people in the deep state who are, building DARPA weapons. I'm sure they're very clever, but I mean these Brookings Institute people are pretty pathetic. I mean, it's just I don't know.
No,
If
that's
you fo if you follow it, you realize that.
yeah. If you ever have the fortune or misfortune of attending a cocktail party in Washington, D.C., or one of these functions, you run into people from Brookings or Heritage, or a CFR for that matter, or people on Capitol Hill. They can never engage in any real meaningful conversation. It's all soundbite talk. They can't say anything of any substance or be real critical of anything because they're terrified of being quoted and then being held accountable for what they say. So they're all very guarded. Nothing they say is ever original. It's all like it's all from a press release type things. That's how they think. They're used to writing press releases. That's how they think.
That's a good point.
No.
Yeah, the only CFR person I ever met was Joe Klein at the Rand Paul, one of Rand Paul's speeches, and he was there to kind of critique it and write against it in Time Magazine or whatever. And I had about a 10-minute conversation with him, and that was the impression I got, was that it's just like talking to somebody who watches CNN all day. It's
Yeah,
like
that's what it is.
not that engaging, not that great, very boring,
Yeah, that's
old line, boring 1980s progressivism from Clinton era. It's like totally out of touch with what's actually going on. Not saying that Rand Paul was that great, but But that was the impression I got from the one CFR person I had a conversation with.
The fact that they find Rand Paul so extreme shows you just how insulated they are.
Exactly, right.
That's how insulated they are.
Yeah.
And they're insulated because they're paid pretty good money. It beats working in a factory if you still have a factory to work in. And it beats an honest living. So you're paid to show up somewhere and type out a few crappy sentences. And you feel you're smart because you're told you're smart. And you have a job doing this, you know, so.
Yeah, and I've experienced the academic realm too, which is where those people inhabit, and I know how foolish those people are too, right? I mean, what's that mm-hmm. dictum that, you know, it takes only an educated person could believe something so ridiculous, or only a professor could, you know, believe something so stupid, but that's really very true. Now, obviously, professors and academics are proficient in their areas, but that's mm-hmm. one of the faults is that compartmentalization that, you know, people are very hyper specialization and they'll know everything about, you know, the history of, I don't know, the history of, Macedonia. And they don't know anything about anything else or something. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, that's the control mechanism, I think, in academia.
Yeah, exactly.
Not those just the fear of, you know, that's also even tenure, as it turns out, is a control mechanism.
Absolutely. You know? Exactly.
Kevin Cole made a good point, about the whole discipline of international relations came out of the Rhodes Circle.
Absolutely, yeah.
So the whole thing, our presuppositions, which you write about, are so important regarding the Enlightenment and, you know, uh-huh. capitalism and free market and Adam Smith and these things, the nature of things, based on Newtonian principles or physics, which is then it was applied politically by the Whigs to justify, I guess, mm-hmm. the Glorious Revolution. Yeah, the whole thing is, that's just why it's, if you watch old movies, or this is why the Japanese or Germans are such fiends and the British are always good, because British conquest of the globe is, that's civilization, but if it's challenged by an upstart power, they're the gangster states, you know.
Yes, exactly, and I didn't realize this either, but it should be pretty obvious. I noticed this week, because I was looking through some of Adam Smith's stuff, I see him quite often speaking of the great architect of the universe. So I'm going to go ahead and venture that Adam Smith was a Mason. So that's pretty telling, I think, of the philosophy at work here.
I think he also didn't have a father, which is an old strategy of the British.
Mm-hmm. I've heard, yeah, that's what they will, they'll do that, yeah.
Bill Clinton, right? Mm-hmm. And also Gloria Steinem, I think, had a bad family's background, too. She was brought in, initiated into the system. So there's a pattern there, you see, with all these things. It's that much is interesting. Here you have Trump. You know, you'd say Trump, I'll quote from the article, once Donald Trump is understood from the perspective of postmodernism, begins to make sense. And it makes sense how and why Trump is generally anti-globalist. Now, even though Trump is not perfect, I think we can have hope that things are generally going to change, or at least for those of us on the right with sympathies with tradition, biblical philosophy, and Russia, we can hope for new possibilities. Even America, a nation purportedly founded upon non-interventionism, might conceivably be altered in its course to at least be a force for the projection of toxic culture and a foreign policy across the globe. Now, that's going to rub a lot of people the wrong way, because America has always been seen as a force for good. It's, after all, it saved the world twice from German and Japanese conquest, right, in the 20th century. It saved the world from communism. this is where you get in, I think, the deeper points you make in your article regarding the Enlightenment and the founding of America, what America represents to the world.
Well, good. Our view of good is determined by what we believe about the world, what our presuppositions are, what our foundational beliefs and maxims happen to be. So for some people, if you, for example, maybe inhabit the scientism realm of academia, depopulation is a good thing, right? Because it's good to keep Mother Earth in balance. It's good to not get out of step with what's sustainable, quote unquote, right? So there's all these assumptions about what the good is based on foundational beliefs about perhaps in that case, naturalism, reductionistic materialism, Darwinism, various views of what the biosphere is and so forth and so on. So that conditions or determines how you believe and read, quote, goodness into the world. Now, we all have these, I believe, worldviews, these systems of belief, but most people don't question them, and they're a product of many things, pop culture, our education, elementary school, parents, all these things kind of go together to form our schema, our scheme of of how we read the world. But I think that if we begin to question these things, and I think perhaps the vanguard of movements are the ones who are questioning things for good or for ill, to move things in various directions, and then of course the population then seems to follow 10, 15, or 20 years down the road. So I've definitely seen that in my lifetime with movements and the popularity of things and things growing and gaining momentum and steam and stuff like that. And so point being just that we're starting to see the cracks and the fissures of the Enlightenment idea. And America is the preeminent Enlightenment nation. Now, some perhaps might have hoped for the complete dismantling of America, or that it would eventually collapse or something like that. I don't think that's going to happen anytime soon. Obviously, it's just such a powerhouse and an engine of economic prosperity and you know, just gigantic military. So America is whether we like it or not. And so from a tactical perspective, I guess you'd have to say, all right, well, could it just be, you know, taken over and turned to good? Absolutely. You know, this is what we saw with the conversion of the empire in the 3rd, 4th, 5th centuries of the church. So, and now, does that mean that I'm saying Trump is Constantine? No, I'm not saying that. I thought that was a funny comparison that you made. But at the same time, you know, what all of this has shown to me is just that, you know, the future's not set. We don't know for certain where things are going. Yeah, there's technocrats. Yes, there's globalists. Yes, they're planning 10, 50, 100 years into the future. But one of their strategies is to project power, to project infallibility, to project the unstoppable juggernaut of globalism. And it doesn't have to be. It doesn't have to be that way. And if that perception of an unstoppable juggernaut ever fell, they'd be done for. The whole thing would fall apart. So, you know, we're starting to see nations take actions against Soros. Now, I understand that's not like the total victory against the New World Order or whatever. But I mean, who could have imagined this like 5, 10 years ago? Like 5 years ago, people still didn't even know about the Bilderberg Group, right? Like, it was like Ron Paul was very edgy, right?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So I have hope for things legitimately changing is all that I see Trump representing. It's not that Trump himself is a savior figure or a god emperor or or a Cyrus or something like this from the Bible, but at the same time, who knows? God can do anything. And, you know, what we have in the Psalms that, you know, the nations of the earth and their kings, you know, rally against God, and God laughs at them. So, I don't know, maybe I'm being naive here, but, you know, I've watched this stuff for a long time, and I've watched people move in the direction of waking up to a lot of this stuff. And that's just, it's becoming popular. Now, does that mean that everything's going to get fixed? No, I'm not saying that. But all I'm saying is that I think we can have hope. And I'm happy with the first 2 weeks of Trump's presidency. Obviously, I'd like to see a lot more, and I'd like to see a lot of things going in different directions. But we can have some optimism.
Yes, there's reason for optimism.
Yeah.
Now, there was an interesting interview with Jeff Rentz and Catherine Austin Fitz recently, And
I saw that, and I was about to hear it, but I didn't get to it. But what was said?
well, in your article, you say, broadly speaking, Trump is pro-life, pro-gun, anti-vaccine, anti-Common Core, anti-Obamacare, anti-eugenics, anti-TPP, anti-open borders, anti-UN, anti-climate change, anti-lobbying, roughly alt-right, pro-Russia, anti-NATO. So he's stepping on a lot of toes there. But Catherine Austin Fitz said, "What, you know, I think we've talked about this before. What, it's not so much Trump, who Trump is, the man. It's what he represents and
Yeah.
how he was able to win. This isn't. I don't think Trump came out of nowhere and just overwhelmed the political system. There are factions
Right.
within the power structure which favor Trump. I think we both talked about that. Catherine Austin Fitz
Yes.
has, Dr. Farrell has talked about that as well, and I think it's a pretty good analysis. I think it may be correct that he represents a faction, a pro-American, mafia faction with the casinos, hospitality industry, which is really affected by some of the policies of the past 20 years, particularly
Yes,
Obamacare.
absolutely.
So this was
Right.
a reaction. So what we're saying is Trump is well within the arena, but there are factions within the arena, and we have to get we basically we have to satisfy ourselves with small victories within the system to somehow make it more civilized, maybe more sustainable, and avoid a catastrophe. So we're dealing with reality here, but what Catherine Austin Fitz said about some of the reaction to Trump by the talking heads, the media, they don't quite get him. What you said in the
Exactly.
article, they don't understand. She says the recent interview. She said the media hacks were hired to pass 10, 15, 20 years at Fox News, at CNN, MSNBC. These guys were all hired to push the globalist model. Now Trump is trying
Right.
to deconstruct the globalist model, and they don't know quite how to react because this is all they know. This, like you said, this is the, these are these. Their presuppositions, or they think in these categories. They don't know what to make of it now.
Yeah, all we've had is total tool politicians in the sense of being totally unified on the agenda. And the media has had to content themselves with talking about cigars and sex scandals. And then here we have the injection of real issues forced into everyone's face, which is pretty phenomenal. I mean, I'm not, well, I'm 38, so I've not lived through a lot of presidents, but I don't remember anything like this. You're older than me. You would know more about this. I mean, obviously there have been contentious pseudo debates about, oh, do we need to go into this foreign country? Oh, what about Iran-Contra? And I remember these kinds of things from my childhood, but I don't ever remember things like vaccines and global warming hoax being thrust into the mainstream media, putting everybody's face like this.
It's either Trump mentions it, and maybe it's mentioned on RT. And that's it. Some of these things. So yeah, it is. It's the hair. I mean, you have a president talking about this stuff, or having talked about this stuff, questioning vaccines, which is a huge agenda right there. So yeah, it is unprecedented, and you just can't dismiss it. There, it represents something within the system changing.
Right, and I think that I said a long time ago in one of the videos that I think in the video that I did on Hillary Clinton and WikiLeaks, I pointed out that Steve Pachinik was on Alex Jones for a long time prior to all this, saying that he was working with WikiLeaks in terms of trying to leak stuff to damage the Clinton campaign. So if we assume that that is true, then that's proof right there of elements of the deep state coming to decide that the globalism sounds good and it makes all these promises, but when it's actually implemented and when it actually starts to spread, it ends up being not good for anybody. And I think that's the big problem here, is that you have a lot of wealthy people who may not be at the super elite, super rich class that are starting to be affected, especially by something like Obamacare. And that hurts businesses big time. That's what it was designed to do. So you're going to have reaction to globalism. And of course, the globalists understood that. They have contingency plans in place, I think, to deal with that. But I think that their contingency plans are kind of out of step with, like, I mean, I don't know that this stuff is working. And maybe I'm being overly optimistic with that. Maybe I'm being too naive or something. But I mean, people seem to be seeing through a lot of this stuff. Now, they're going to have backup plans of like, they're going to start fake alternative media and independent media sites, which they've already been doing for a long time. MoveOn.org and all these different sites that are pretending to be independent media, Daily Beast, and all this kind of stuff. They just parrot the mainstream media line. But I don't know, man. I'm seeing a lot of people waking up to a lot of things that you were not allowed to talk about 10 years ago. And I was watching internet indie media stuff intently. I've watched it for 10 years straight, and I know what you could say 10 years ago because I had a blog 10 years ago, and I would talk about certain things, and I would get warned, and I would get threatened. And I see thousands and thousands and thousands of people saying these kinds of things now in forums and on chat rooms and YouTube comments and on mainstream media articles. I see people harassing these CNN pundits and these think tanks, and I think people are seeing through a lot of this. Now, could that all be a ruse? Could that be foreseen and planned? Probably, but I mean, when you're, I think Alex Jones made this point one time that, you know, when you're wealthy and you've gone along with the system and you believe it, and then your kid gets autism, it affects you. And you start to see this stuff. And I think that it's very unfortunate. I'm not saying that autism is good or people having problems with vaccines or the medical system but when it starts hurting their business and their family, people are going to start realizing this.
Well, when you go from what one in what was the rate 30 years ago to one in what
Oh yeah,
five,
the autism rate, yeah, and then
one in 100 or one in 75 or some states or something?
Or when they look around their hometown and it's unrecognizable from what it was 15 years earlier, 10 years earlier, because it's a completely different demographic of people.
Well, that was just his one of his, you know, this executive order banning Muslims, supposedly, when all of a sudden this reaction is now it's just presumed that people have a right to come to the United States as if there's some sort of civil right being violated here. I think what, yeah, I think it was like 65% of people who apply for visas are accepted into the United States, and we have the more liberal immigration policies. That's but even by law, not to mention the laws that are broken immigration. But that's another issue here is we're not just dealing with people coming to seek out a better life, and this, we have situations where this migration has become weaponized.
Yes, Kelly Greenhill's paper and book, and Peter Sutherland of the EU on the BBC, he's in charge of the UN's migrant relocation program, and he just sits up there and explicitly says this is to destroy the existing countries.
Yeah, and like I said, you have Pope Francis going, exhorting people in Europe to take people in, but he just says nothing about NATO policy in Syria or Libya that destroys these countries, which causes the diaspora into Europe. And
Exactly.
to me, you should be addressing that, the wars that are fomented by
Yeah, what's
NATO
the
and the West.
cause of the migrants? What's the cause of all the cancer? What's the cause of all the autism? Cause it's the effects are always addressed as some dialectical problem reaction solution baloney, and they never ever talk about the causes because once we start looking at the causes, then the entire existing establishment comes into view as the cause.
And now, then you get into Freemasonry. Problem, reaction, solution. But you listed here, you said, according to Quigley, the 20th century America was almost wholly dominated by Atlanticist globalist faction of the oligarchic elite and was only legitimately opposed by a single movement, the America Firsters, who were never fully succeeded in halting the machinations of the Cliveden set, the British intelligence, to maneuver the U.S. into World War II. Thus, Quigley admits U.S. was unanimously under the grip of the banking power and a particular use as an engine for its foreign policy. And you list here is what Trump's legitimate problems. Sorry, here is where Trump is a legitimate problem for globalism. In my view, the danger of globalism centers around a handful of threats. First, usury, debt, gold-based monetary structures, subversion of churches, traditional religious institutions, or co-opting, subversion of families, patriarchy, human sexuality through toxic culture, the erasing of existing ethnic distinctions and culture distinctions, creating a single global free trade marketplace, global military bases of militarization. You go on with a couple other problems here. But when you're listening, some of these things are considered sort of modern-day pieties or verities, like integration, assimilation, racial integration, these things, mixing people together, sexual freedom, tolerance towards deviance, sexual behavior in all forms. And these things have gradually become accepted as, well, if not normal, as something that we are forced to tolerate, lest we be called, you know, a bigot or a racist or, you know, just a subhuman.
Yes.
Now, that's a trick that's been played over the years, because that's part of the psychological warfare that we've been subjected to, because part of that is to deny people even the basic language to articulate their problems they have with these things. And part of that is to call them names, of course, to insult them, and also to accuse them of being, you know, bad people for opposing some of these things. Good example is I've noticed the use of the word transphobe.
Yes.
And that comes from, of course, that's an extension of homophobe. Whereas now, if you have misgivings or a moral problem with someone's chosen behavior, you are now a bigot. I mean, it used to be...
Yeah, you're going to be a pedophobe soon.
Yeah, that's the next step. Because they're trying to normalize that. And that began back in the 50s with Alfred Kinsey and, of course, the Rockefeller, the Ford Foundation, all the usual suspects.
Yes.
So all this deviancy has gotten all the support of the establishment. You know, so...
And that's the key point here, is that you can weaponize human sexuality, and that's the chief... Well, one of the ways to illustrate the weakness of the libertarian position is that you can't have a coherent worldview in opposition to all this stuff that doesn't have a place for the human person. And my view is that liberty and is grounded actually in law, divine law, first of all, first and foremost.
Mm-hmm.
And the only way to have liberty is to have that presupposes that the active agent who's doing these free actions is a person. In my view, the only way to have personhood and a coherent philosophy of human persons is if they're made in the image of a divine person. And that's at least the history of Western and Eastern Christian thought. And that's one of the great things that was bequeathed to the earth through, you know, the revelation of given to Moses and then propounded through the church. So this is actually a great guarantor of rights for individuals. And once you've tossed that out and you've interjected this materialism, this atomism, this deism, all this enlightenment stuff, it's not very far down the road before natural rights just becomes meaningless. And this is an argument I often make with when I argue with libertarians, is that you don't have a basis for liberty without some kind of law that extends beyond just the state, or just quote natural rights. Because when I look, if I say, let's say there's no God for a moment, let's set aside the Bible or Christianity or Christian history or Christian tradition or whatever, set all that aside, and we say that there's just natural law, natural rights that we derive from reason, that we all come together and we have a social contract and we, you know, draw up this document or whatever, and we sprinkle some powdered wig magic on it, like Chris talks about. Then the problem is that when I look at nature, I see predators and prey. So there's no coherent reason why you can impose upon me the limitations of the non-aggression principle that I don't have some natural right to dominate you as predator to prey. So once you've adopted Darwinism, social Darwinism, it seems to me to lead to the conclusion, if you were consistent with it, that you know, some Nietzschean Ubermensch couldn't come along and just stamp everybody out. So then there's no real coherent reason why you shouldn't adopt that view, right? Because we've tossed out the ideas of objective standards and truth, which I believe truly is grounded in theism and theology. Now, that's a kind of presuppositional critique or question that nobody in the Enlightenment era did, because they didn't think in those categories. Nobody thought to really question that kind of level of assumption. This is something that kind of comes about later on in philosophy, and even in postmodern thought, actually, is very. That's its one redeeming aspect, is that it's willing to question foundations. Now, their answer is that everything is just grand narrative and there's no truth, which I don't agree with. But postmodernism is illustrative in its ability to question assumptions, and particularly to question the prevailing Enlightenment liberal assumptions. So anyway, long story short, I just think that the best way to have the guarantee of the dignity of the human person is if we have the church involved in society, and if we have a belief in God, and if we have these kinds of foundations. Because this is what, you know, for example, you know, the Romans used to toss out girls, at least the story is. Like, they didn't view female children as having a whole lot of worth. And the male children were perceived to have a lot more worth. So oftentimes, you know, you would have just people tossed out. Now, we see remnants of this in places like pagan cultures like India, right, where you have the, what do you call the, like the lower caste, right? They're just sort of cast out.
The untouchables.
The untouchables are worthless, right? Well, so, I mean, it's Christian theology, again, that guarantees the dignity of every individual person. Right. And so we can talk all day about the rights of the individual, but if you don't have a notion of personhood, which I think comes from good philosophy and theology, it ends up ultimately just meaning nothing. So that's what I think is important to understand.
Yeah, that's an important point. I think you talked about that in your recent episode regarding Seraphim Rose.
And, yes.
Which was an interesting talk, which I think is relevant to what we're talking about this evening.
Mm-hmm.
But you mentioned sort of this mechanistic scientistic view of the world. And right now I'm reading E. Michael Jones's book, Barren Metal. And mm-hmm. It gets into that. He gets in the Newtonian world. And mm-hmm. This is what he wrote here. John Locke saw in Newton's Principia a new source of political legitimacy, the one that thing that the Whig revolutionaries lacked when they placed the usurper on the throne. Mm-hmm. The Glorious Revolution gave Locke and his Whig supporters the chance to implement Newtonianism as the philosophy which would grant legitimacy to the usurper William of Orange and the Whig ideology, otherwise known as capitalism. Force is the crucial feature of Newtonian physics, and Newton's cosmology was a rationalization in just about every sense of the word of force. Motion redefined, no longer bespoke of telos, or a goal, as it had in the Aristotelian system. Motion was now extrinsic to the bodies in the motion, and another word for that extrinsic motion was force. Whig magnates digested the lesson of Principia with the help of the propagandists like Locke, and they learned that all motion was caused, not by intellecti leading them to their proper, or telos, but by external force, which was totally arbitrary. In that sense, much like the force William of Orange, which puts James II in motion, ending in exile, and drove him from his rightful position, now associated with the outmoded concept of absolute place, where the earth and the water dwelt below, and fire was up and earth down, there was no longer any proper end to motion. Every motion was arbitrary and a function of force. And mm-hmm. that had a profound impact on philosophy, because you see that philosophy, well, put him in, inform the whole ideology of the British Empire from that point on, correct?
If you remember back to the conversation that you and I had a year or two ago, nominalist economics, mm-hmm. that was the point I was trying to make in that essay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and exactly. So here we have this rationalization. You know, this is the whole thing where, well, one thing is that you could rationalize almost anything if you... This gets into, of course, the development of Darwinism, which is sort of you could say applied alchemy to the natural world. Would that be fair?
Absolutely. And see, that's what's important to understand here is that you can't really do political philosophy or economic philosophy outside of all these metaphysical concerns, because it's all going to affect each other.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the very point that E. Michael Jones is making there, the same point I've tried to make
mm-hmm.
many times in articles, is that if we adopt a certain view of physics, even though, let's say I adopted Newtonian physics suddenly, and then perhaps I write a bunch of books on economics, and maybe my economic books have good points. But what happens is that I believe humans over time become more consistent with their assumptions or their starting points or their beliefs. So it's not always manifested immediately. You know, the problems with Enlightenment philosophy don't always immediately manifest in the people of that day, in John Locke's writings or whatever. And there might be good points in, mm-hmm. you know, John Locke's treatises on government or something. I mean, I did read it back in my undergrad days. And, you know, every now and then he'll make an interesting point. And so it's not that the entire, you know, worldview is completely wrong, because I don't think that's how human thought and philosophy works. It's not an all or nothing thing. But if we have certain governing beliefs that condition the rest of our worldview, then what happens is over time we as we live these things out, we either become more consistent with the bad parts of our belief system or with the good parts, and we either move towards the good or we move away from the good, is what I'm trying to say.
Mm-hmm.
And this applies also, I believe, collectively in societies and in nations and in ages. Actually, you could probably argue the ages of men maybe even manifest these spirit, so to speak. I don't mean spirit in the sense of like a demon, but like the spirit of an age is the way Hegel talks, or the way Spengler talks about the spirit of an empire or something like that, and that they have these cycles. I think there's something to all that, and I think that's what we're looking at here is so E. Michael Jones is absolutely right in that point, what he's making by saying, and Farrell has made this point too, that the metaphysics that's adopted by different civilizations or societies, this eventually conditions the economic theory. It conditions the political theory. So, you know, I know that this might seem strange or difficult, but that's just because we don't think in these terms anymore. We think in American pragmatic terms, or we think in science terms, right? We think in scientism and stuff like this, but you know, I actually think it's very different. I think it works the way we're talking about mm-hmm. right now.
One thing that got me thinking when I read that part of that book was, you know, the whole Newtonian physics being applied to rationalize capitalism and usury. You know, the sacredness of the contract and the well, one thing is usury was sort of a revitalization of the idea of the philosopher's stone, alchemy.
Mm-hmm.
You could, you know, make money out of nothing, which is what usury does, right?
Yes, I have an article on that the banksters are alchemists. Yes.
Now I'm just thought about this because I remember reading Paul Johnson's Modern Times, and early in that book he talks about the theory of relativity, Einstein, how it was proven it was 1920-21. And it overturned the Newtonian mm-hmm. world. And this had profound political mm-hmm. social effects, because the theory of relativity, from a cosmological standpoint, affected the political and social and led to led to the travesty of the 20th century. Now, what I got out of that was Newtonian world view was opposed to the Einstein world relatively, the fixed Newtonian world, opposed to the Einstein and relativity world of relativity.
Mm-hmm.
What I'm looking at, I'm thinking more in terms of dialectics. Was Newtonian vision for necessary in order for the Einstein theory of relativity to be applied later on?
That's an interesting question. I would say that relativity is just postmodernism applied to physics, because postmodernism says that everything is a grand narrative mm-hmm. and it's your story, it's my story, it's my myth. The Enlightenment had its myth. Christianity was a myth. Science is a myth. Nietzsche, really, is what we're talking about here. And so Nietzsche is like the preeminent relativist. Mm-hmm. So, yes. But I think these are, yes, they're dialectics, because that the truth is not purely physical reality, as opposed to some purely quantum physic phantasm, illusory reality. I mean, they always try to. Who was I reading that was talking about? Somebody had a brilliant analysis. Maybe Wolfgang Smith. I think he has some really good critiques along these lines. But they were talking about how the attempt was to smush everything into one story. And if you and this sort of comes out of that Newtonian period, that if you could categorize everything under one thing, then you could like find the code for everything. And this is a failed project because it assumes from the outset that everything is one thing. that may not be the case, right?
Isn't that like the unifying theory?
Yeah, yes, a unified theory of physics, and yes, exactly. But if you read, I think it's Cosmos and Transcendence by Wolfgang Smith, which is actually not a very, very big book. It's a couple hundred pages, but it's a phenomenal critique of scientism Newtonianism that you're talking about, and I believe Wolfgang is a Catholic, so he's coming from a Catholic perspective. It's a great book, though.
well, our view of
but,
science.
But let me give you an example of this for science. If you read Thomas Kuhn's Structures of Scientific Revolution, he's excellent in his critique of the Newtonian Revolution, because he points out that scientific revolutions don't occur the way that scientism says it does. Scientism has the mythology about itself that scientific revolutions occur based on the Great Council of Scientists all coming together and objectively looking at the facts, and then we've all been wrong, and therefore we all declare that this is now the new truth. That's not how it happens. It happens in terms of the reality of how humans are, that if somebody does discover something that challenges the existing paradigm, it's attacked. It's hated. Mm-hmm. It's fought tooth and nail because nobody wants. Who wants to admit they're wrong, right? So there's this very naive, stupid view about human nature that's involved in naive scientism and empiricism. and so Kuhn is right about all that. However, what's Kuhn's response? Well, he falls into this kind of postmodern thing where he's like, all we have is competing paradigms, and there's no way to know which of the paradigms is true.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, a lot of the philosophical work that I've tried to do is that's where I look into transcendental arguments and presuppositions, and trying to show that that's actually just that's still basing one's notion of truth on what we call a classical foundationalist epistemology, which is the idea that truth is. Starts from foundational maxims, and then you kind of build a superstructure based on a foundational maxim that nobody questions. And you just can't even ask the question of, well, how do we know that the foundational maxim is true? Well, there's other possibilities that philosophers and theologians and thinkers have posed that just apparently seem to be forgotten or nobody ever looks at. But there's other options here. Like, we don't have to say that we don't have to start with classical foundationalism or to toss it out and be a relativist, right? Like, that's not the only two options. There's other options out there in philosophy, like coherence theory of truth, right? That truth might be known or determined within a web of beliefs, and that that the web of beliefs and its coherence, which is something that's actually sort of intuitive that humans have. We have this intuitive sense of like, we almost kind of immediately know when something is rational or coherent. We have this faculty, like it's almost like a God-given faculty, actually, that the psyche, the mind, knows how to decode meaning, and it knows how to place things in a kind of coherent view of the world. Like, the mind just kind of functions this way. We don't know everything about that. It can't be put under a microscope, but it seems to work that way. And the fact that you and I can have a conversation and exchange meaningful terms and words and sentences presupposes that kind of a world, right? So actually, a lot of philosophers who've kind of worked in this field have done a lot of linguistic work. So they'll talk about how linguistic philosophy puts us in this direction.
Yeah.
of what we might call a coherence theory of truth. So anyway, that's what that may be way off topic where you wanted to go, but yeah, everybody, if you are interested in these questions and apologetics and philosophy, I highly recommend Cosmos and Transcendence. It's a great critique of scientism.
There is a scene in the TV series Breaking Bad, where Walter White is a chemist, and it's a flashback to his youth where he's courting this young lady who's also a chemist, and they're in a lab or they're, and he's worked out he's breaking down the human body by chemicals, compound by compound, and kind of. And he has it numbered, 25%, 35%, 47%. And he only get up to like 92%. And there's the gap. Oh, what do we have here? And the young lady says, "Oh, how about the soul?" And he just laughs it off, which is a kind of a window into his tragic character. He's just discounting the soul, and she's willing to some things you can't quantify. And you're showing it with your formula suggests that, and he just laughs it off. I thought that was an interesting scene in that movie. But we're talking about in that TV series rather. But we're talking about science itself. Of course, our notion of science grew out of the Royal Society, which is a Freemasonic organization, for what I understand.
Yes,
and it was formed around 1660, and that's the middle of the English Civil War. So you put it in its context of a lot of turmoil, like the Great Fire of London, the plague. You have this whole Catholic Protestant thing going on there. So you really can't. Science itself was born in the fire of tumult and revolution. So it can never be objective. You can't take it outside its social or political context, correct? I mean,
yeah, this is one of the great insights of of Heidegger. And so if you want a very, very technical, very difficult, but adequate critique of scientism, you can look at Husserl's logical investigations. Now, this would be for the academic because it's a very, very difficult text. It's not for everybody. But one of Husserl's great points in this text is that the scientific method operates on principles of logic. And logic is not something that you can empirically verify for existence, right? Mm-hmm. So this is the question of metalogic. So we can talk all day about syllogisms and modus ponens or modus tollens and different functions of logic. But if we ask a different question, like how do we know that logic exists, or that it is coherent, or that it is something that actually relates to the world? These are different questions outside of logic proper, right? But they're legitimate questions, and a lot of philosophers and logicians and mathematicians have asked that question. So Husserl was a mathematician by training who eventually got into philosophy. So Husserl said, now I'm not saying that he's right about everything, but he did notice, he said, hey, when we're doing science, we're operating on principles, and we're assuming a lot of logical principles that we think are going to apply to the scientific process, right? So, for example, the principle of induction, that the future will be like the past. We assume that in the scientific process, but it's not something that can strictly logically be proven. Like, you can't empirically demonstrate that the future will be like the past because we're always in the present, right? like, there's no way to show exactly what's going to happen tomorrow. So you have to kind of assume certain things about the world, like regularity in nature. And this is where we have in logic what's called the principle of induction. So Husserl says, now if you look at something like this, this shows that even in what we're calling the scientific method or the scientific process that's going on in the lab, or when people are, coming up with a theory and testing it and so forth, this shows that there's more at work. There's some kind of logos behind this that is guiding this process to be sensible and to have some purpose. And I think he's right about that. Now, Husserl still thought that you could do a lot of this stuff abstractly, and that you could actually set aside every presupposition that you had, and that that you could somehow come to like a position of seeing and understanding a brute fact, like if you meditated on something long enough. And there's this story that Husserl took his when he's doing the phenomenological process, like he took all of his students out one time and they were like looking at a mailbox, and supposedly they spent the entire semester like investigating and looking at the mailbox. And this was all in this process of trying to get at like the objective perspective of the mailbox. But of course, you know, being that humans always have one vantage point of something, like there's always what's called the horizon of an object, right? So if you're looking at a house from the front, you can't simultaneously look at the back, right? So there's always some hidden aspect to a thing. Even if you're, you know, you walk around the house and you see all the sides of it, you're always at one point of the house. You can never see it from a God's eye perspective.
Yeah, this is perspective, yeah.
So Husserl, I think, is very insightful, and he's good at critiquing things like scientism and stuff like that. But he also kind of, you know, fell into still some of these Enlightenment dialectics and problems of not getting us beyond, you know, just kind of like some of the, again, the problems of the Enlightenment and rationalism. And where Heidegger is insightful, and I'm not saying that Heidegger is right about everything either, I'm just saying that you get this conversation in philosophy where it's always sort of enlightening itself and critiquing itself, which can be a good thing. So Heidegger comes along and says, look, you can stand outside and stare at a mailbox all semester. You're never going to get to an objective perspective of the mailbox because you're forgetting one huge factor, and that's life being, or the fact that we're human beings who live a life. We're not just cameras or camcorders that are out there recording our experiences of a mailbox. Like when I come to the experience of a mailbox, I come with everything that I've ever thought or lived or experienced about mailboxes and everything else in my life, right? Like maybe I hit my head on a mailbox when I was a kid and I just can't freaking stand mailboxes, right? So, and everybody's going to have some bias or story, I guess you could say, to interpret objects in the world. And so Heidegger says that there's no, it's a mistake to think that you can approach these things from a purely objective brute fact vantage point. That doesn't exist, because that's a myth of the Enlightenment, the idea of brute factuality. And once you understand that, I think it's much easier to critique scientism and the ideas of Darwinism and the idea, in my view, and the ideas of a lot of the stuff that comes out of the Enlightenment, because you understand that we're not saying that you can't do science. We're not saying that you can't make advances in the lab. We're not saying that you can't do engineering and computer technology or anything like that, or that you can't do mathematics. It's just that none of these things operates in a vacuum. Like mathematics is something that you still had to learn, right? You still had to be part of some tradition by which you were taught the principles of mathematics, you know, unless like you got hit on the head and you suddenly developed like the, you know, the ability to do quantum algorithms or something crazy like that.
It's like the computer wore tennis shoes. I don't know if you remember that old movie.
Yeah. Somebody was bringing that up the other day. So for most of us, for 99.9% of the population, you know, we learned logic through the inheritance of the Western academic tradition, you know, from Aristotle and so forth. We learned geometry from the inheritance of, you know, the Greek Pythagorean tradition or whatever, mm-hmm. Euclidean tradition, so forth. So it's a mistake, first and foremost, to think that it's possible to gain the Enlightenment neutrality, brute factuality approach to things, because everything in the world, including ourselves, is part of a story. And that's what has been completely jettisoned by the Enlightenment. Now, but that's not to say that we rush to the opposite extreme and become a Nietzschean and say, oh, then it's all a story and it's all relative. And by golly, I'm going to enforce my story on you. Right? I'm going to be the Ubermensch, and you either submit to the story that I'm making up or I crush you under my boot. Right. So we don't have to go down either of those routes. And what's amazing, what I find still compelling about the traditional Christian perspective is that it takes into account all of these things. Right. We have a world where it makes sense that there's, say, regularity in nature because of providence. Right. The future will be like the past because there's such a thing as divine providence. Right. God made a covenant with Noah where he said that the seasons will continue as they've continued and so forth. There's a logical process to science and mathematics because God is logos, right? This is what we have in the beginning of the book of John.
Yeah, and this is what the Greeks were coming across with their mathematical philosophy, right?
I believe so. Yeah.
They saw precision and perfection in mathematics, and that was kind of like the development of monotheism. At least that's what I remember from my early notions of monotheism. Developed out of the sort of this the one, the sort of precision and philosophy.
This is an interesting question, a different topic, because there's a lot of debate over whether Jewish prophets had interaction with Plato, or whether Plato might have had interaction with the Jewish prophets. So there's a lot of very difficult speculative debate about this. Actually, a lot of papers and books have been written about this, and I'm not sure exactly what the answer is here, but I think it's very plausible that Plato could have been influenced by maybe he read the book of Isaiah somehow, or who knows. I don't know, but that is an interesting question. Mm-hmm. Then you also have the Jewish diaspora in Egypt. Some people think is the Hyksos, and that the reason that Egypt eventually adopted monotheism is perhaps because of the time period that the Jews spent in Egypt. And that's a very, I think, plausible thesis. If you read the book of Genesis, Joseph is raised to number two in Egypt, right? So he's right under Pharaoh towards the end of Genesis. But
that's right. His brothers planned it. They exile him, right? And that's, he becomes the advisor. And then he saves their lives or something.
Exactly. But now that's all viewed as ludicrous, from the academic perspective, because obviously there's nothing true about any of that. That's all just made up mythology. But what's interesting about the so-called objectivity of science and academia and history is that we'll believe and look into anything but the biblical texts as a possible historical account, right? Anything, panspermia and aliens, that's all possible. None of this stuff in Genesis, though, so... Anyway, that's a different
angels,
topic.
Angels, no. Aliens, yes. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Exactly.
Because aliens are kind of like would be this sort of postmodern. They don't impose any stricture or traditional morality or anything like that. Whereas they.
Yeah. You're not gonna. You can rape kids, and the aliens don't care.
It's like you said, Donald Trump talks about the aliens. You're talking on your talk.
Right. They're going to bring back. Yeah, the alien visitors always seem to mysteriously have a message that lines up with the globalists and the Rockefellers and these kinds of characters. It never seems to be anything like, anything good. Right? Like,
there aren't any
jobs are coming back or something.
There's no alt-right aliens out there. Now, in all this, okay, so Donald Trump, whether he knows it or not, he's helping deconstruct. He's here at the tail end, sort of the reductio ad absurdum of the Enlightenment period we're experiencing now, of all the transgenderism.
Yes, that's a good way to put it. Yeah.
The insanity of it all, the sort of this breaking of all limitation idea that we're free to do anything and there's no limitations, not even natural laws anymore. So we can break these laws and not face any consequences. And when we do face the consequences, we blame somebody else. Well, juxtaposed to Donald Trump, of course, is Vladimir Putin in Russia, and Russia represents in all this, because obviously Donald Trump is perceived as being more friendly to Russia. So, what role does Russia play in all this in this twilight of the Enlightenment?
Well, it's what Quigley said that Russia represents. With one of the foes to the Atlanticists that had to be weakened and destroyed. This is what Friedkin at Stratfor says that we've talked about in the past. But it's very difficult to this is one of the reasons I don't think the globalists are infallible or have God powers, is if they did, then they would have wiped out, you know, all this stuff a long time ago. Like, mm-hmm. There would be no pro-life movement. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
There would be GMOs in Europe, right? And I'm not saying that means that the EU is good, but I'm just saying if they had their way, they would already be, you know, moving in those directions and already have that stuff passed.
And I wouldn't be reading a 1,400-page book by E. Michael Jones. So.
Mm-hmm.
If they had their
way. So. There you go, yeah.
One thing also is what they've overplayed their hand with Victoria Nuland. We saw this play out in the past few years, is they seem to at least unify the Eurasian landmass, which contradicts the Mackinder Doctrine. Or at least they're moving that way, right? I mean, it seems they're doing the quite opposite, you know, like in the Ukraine and these things.
Well, I think they thought that you know, if you're a technocrat, if you're the banker, you know, you might get BRICS and some kind of giant Eurasian banking scam out of all that. But I think that's all that only works insofar as, you know, people are kept away from, you know, traditional religious belief.
Yeah.
And Carl Bildt, the EU guy, you know, he's the one who had the tweet saying that, you know, we gotta watch out for the resurgence of Christianity in Russia. Right. This is the problem. We got to watch out for this. Right.
Now, I was told for a century. I mean, I was told that we must pray for the conversion of Russia. Right. Remember, I mean, that's as a Catholic, you know, I was, you know, the conversion of Russia. This is the whole was it the Lady of Fatima and all that?
Well, yeah, but.
But now we're told that a Christian Russia is a threat. Of course, it's Orthodox. So there you go. So.
Yeah. And the. You know, the present papacy doesn't even believe in converting people. So that doesn't make any sense to me. So,
well, according to Abe Foxman, conversion is genocide.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Okay.
You're right. You're right. That's all part of the ecumenical movement, which was, seemed to take hold in the 60s with the council and all that. But,
well, the Russian Church, and this does not mean that everybody in the Russian Church is good. I'm sure there's agents there as well as anywhere else. You know, you've talked about the Wim Hof book in relationship to the Roman Catholic Church. Mm-hmm. We know the KGB put people in the Russian Church, and it became an apparatus of the state and all that. But I mean, the Moscow Patriarchate even said recently they made a statement about. Christian patriotism means that it's good to support your own kin and your own nation. And they called out globalism and Zionism and the New World Order. So to me, I think that's a good thing. So I don't think we have to overthink this and think that everybody's evil and everybody in Russia is evil. It's just not true. And I've never been to Russia. I don't know what it's like on the ground, right? But
yeah.
I know people who are Russian analysts, and you know, I have a high view of Mark Hackard, and you know, he swears by people in Russia are genuinely returning to Christianity, which I think is a good thing after all these years of Sovietism and Bolshevism and all this garbage, right?
Which were Western imports,
exactly.
Masonic Western imports. You blame the barbaric East for that, but it was. It's like Pepsi and Coke imported into Russia.
There was some documentary that was really good. I can't remember the name of it, but it was on Netflix a couple years ago. But it was actually comparing what it was like in the Soviet Union to what it's like in America with corporations.
Mm-hmm.
And it was very similar. Now, they were obviously they were much poorer, you know, in Russia. But it wasn't as different as you would think in terms of like daily lifestyles. What I'm trying to say.
Yeah, the corporate structure. There is a scene in the Sopranos where the two local guys working for Tony Soprano's outfit, two thugs, walk into a coffee shop, and it's this new mall, and it's supposed to be like Starbucks, a chain type operation. And they approach this manager. The manager's there wiping off the counter or something. And he goes, you're the manager. John, the manager. Glad to meet you, John. And the two guys sitting there, no, we're from the New Bergen neighborhood improvement society here, and we're concerned about your business here. Now, although this is an up-and-coming community, it's still diverse if you get our drift, and there's still some problems. It would be a shame if something were to happen to your shop, and we're here to offer your protection. And he goes, I don't know, I can't authorize anything like that. I have to go through corporate. And they go, what would corporate think if the manager got a broken nose or broken leg? And he goes, I don't think they'd care. They hire somebody else. Well, how about someone threw a rock through the window? I don't think they own 20,000 shops. I don't think they feel it at all. He says, listen, but if the manager gets wise to what they're doing, he says, listen, they count every effing bean in this place. I got no discretionary funds here. You hurt me. You got a new manager. They don't care. And then the two thugs leave dejectedly, and they go, ain't nothing left for the little guy anymore.
Exactly.
And then, now, how did, you know, basically you have two thugs here, two small-time officers taking on the big-time mob, which is the which is the corporation. That was very funny.
That's a great point, yeah.
Russia and Putin, and I think I mentioned in my emails, I was talking to George Webb.
Yeah, I heard that was a great interview.
Yeah, he, fascinating guy. He's just really, I mean, but he claims that when Putin was a lieutenant colonel in the KGB, he wrote a white paper that said that Russia could no longer compete with the West's propaganda machine. And outfits like TASS and Pravda, Izvestia, they're just this sort of hackneyed propaganda, just was completely ineffective, and they have to resort to the truth. And so the idea is, just as a practical matter, for the time being, I'm not saying Putin is a saint, that everything that comes out of the Russian government is true. Mm-hmm. They're not capable of engaging their own deep state operations and machinations. But given the balance of power of things right now, the West is so corrupt, and its media institutions, its governmental institutions, its organs of information that are so corrupt, that Russia can, on the cheap, outmaneuver the West, because the truth is always cheaper than telling lies. And so that's kind of what RT is doing now. No.
Yeah, and this is why the you'll get more truth out of that media. That's a great point. Yeah. Interesting.
And so that was an interesting point. This isn't. I'm not saying I'm not skeptical, but I'm saying obviously if you watch some of the people that go in RT, and it's a diverse group, and you know that it's pro Russian, but it's a it's a counterbalance. So say you have to discount these things, but usually people who watch RT are usually sophisticated enough to understand that.
Think about it in terms of like a local example that backs that up. Like, if I'm going to approach, you know, the system presently and what I do in my puny attempt at independent media, I'm going to tell the truth because that's going to resonate.
Yeah.
Like, it's not going to do me any good to lie. And like if my blog just started reprinting CNN or something, like it would totally die. So it makes perfect tactical sense. Just even from a pragmatic tactical sense, it makes sense to do that because that's the only way to counteract the juggernaut.
Yeah, I'm surprised one day I go on your website and your article is Scarlett Johansson wows in white and red dress or something. What the?
It'll just be it'll be me dressed up in a Wolf Blitzer suit. Yeah. Costume. It'll be a Wolf Blitzer costume, and I'll call this the Situation Room or something.
But here's the value of RT. I was reading an Atlantic article about RT. And it goes, Russia Today was conceived as a soft power tool to improve Russia's image abroad to counter the anti-Russian bias the Kremlin saw in the Western media. Since its founding in 2005, however, the broadcast outlet has become better known as an extension of former President Vladimir Putin's confrontational foreign policy. Confrontational, that's funny. right. Which direction is NATO moving? Anyway, They have a quote from, I think it's Peter Lavelle has a show on Russia Today. They put out, Russia had some ads put out in UK, and they featured images of Obama and Iran's Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, and asked, who poses a greater nuclear threat? I think it's great. Or who conflated pictures of a polar bear and an alien next to the text, climate change, science fact, or science fiction? Now, these things were eventually pulled, which is ridiculous. But I think those are great ads. Yeah, I mean, there's nothing wrong with that. It's a legitimate point of view. But in the next paragraph, it goes, coverage and stunts like these have given RT a bad reputation. Yeah, right. Among who? Especially among other Western journalists, because they're trustworthy. Working in Russia, who see RT not as a journalism from the other side of the trenches, but as nothing more than the Kremlin as Kremlin propaganda. Lavelle sneers at what he sees as supreme naivete. The paymaster determines a lot, he says. Are you telling me that Murdoch doesn't control the editorial line of his publications? No one can escape who pays for what. He says he avoids contact with Western colleagues in Moscow, who are in turn supremely contemptuous of most anyone who works for RT. I am proud of my work, Lavelle told me defiantly. That's in an article that I pulled. But I thought that was interesting because the whole, and what we know about the press, the media establishment in the West, for almost the entire century. Come on. It has been as probably much more effectively controlled than the media was in Russia because it's much more sophisticated.
Hasn't Udo Ofkata, isn't he dead now?
Yeah, he died of a heart attack.
Uh-huh.
You know, yeah. You know, they...
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
And no, I mean, yeah, maybe he did, but... yeah.
When his story came out a year and a half ago, I posted on a blog somewhere, I said, hope he's taking precautions. Don't be too surprised if he dies of a heart attack.
You said that? Wow.
As a joke. I think I was on somewhere on like... I just post like a quick comment somewhere. I forget where it was. But, you know, okay. What did he say, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, there's an interesting chapter in... I mean, I don't know anything about the inside workings of the Kremlin. But Dugin has a chapter where he discusses present-day Russia, and I'm assuming it's accurate. I don't know, but he basically says that you have this globalist faction in Russia too, and mm-hmm. that's presumably what Peter Lavelle's talking about too.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, they have a lot of power in terms of the corporate world and in terms of Russian politics and in the Duma, and you know, so Russia, I think, is trying to have it's also trying to do this stuff externally, and it's got its own internal battles. So, you know, and they're still trying to fight their way out of bad economic times under
Yeltsin.
And I was actually reading, it's not good in the sense of like a positive appraisal, but the Institute for Strategic Services has this big paper they put out about Russia a couple days ago or maybe a week ago. That I've been reading that's, you know, a Western think tank analysis of Russia. And this is basically what they're saying, too. So this leads me to think that, you know, this is probably all accurate, that Russia is having its own internal struggle of trying to find itself as a traditional nation. And so, you know, even if Putin's motivations are completely pragmatic, you know, how it's not a bad thing, right, you know, to be against GMOs. It's not a bad thing to try to get your population to reproduce. You know what I mean?
Yes. Yeah.
Because these same things have been foisted everywhere. You know, I mean, I don't think that it's accidental that wherever democratic Masonic republics are set up, you get abortion. You get eventually gay marriage, right? I mean, look at these Catholic countries like Portugal, Spain, right? Mm-hmm. Ireland, you know, and I think that if you want to understand some of what's going on with Trump and the deep state behind him, I think maybe even Israelis are recognizing that, you know, you've got abortion, you've got this stuff in, you've got giant gay community in Tel Aviv.
Yeah.
Once you unleash Pandora's box, it's going to affect your people too. So, you know what I mean?
Yeah, the process of decomposition, demoralization occurs because it is it's a death cult because
Yes, I was just reading in Isaiah where God says he talks about your covenant with death when he's rebuking the Israelites for their apostasy, and he talks about a covenant with death, and it just made me think about all this kind of stuff that we're seeing and again if you. It's just like I'm assuming that humans, you know, in other countries have the similar experience that we have here on a day-to-day basis. You know, it's not like Trump represents or determines everything in relationship to me or you or the rest of the people who might have pro-life, pro-Christian, pro-Bible, pro-theology, pro-tradition views, right? It's really not dependent on Trump. And I would guess that it's the same way in Russia. You know what I mean? It's not dependent on the character of Putin, because you've got a whole nation of millions of people. You know what I mean? So that's where info war comes into it, and trying to influence people's perception and so forth. And that's where the independent media has become, so successful, and why it's beating these mainstream outlets is that they can't compete. And I think this is all true. And doesn't matter who's, whether Alex Jones's motives are good or bad or whatever. It's just, you can look at these things as reflections of legitimate opposition. And that was really, the whole point of what I was just trying to make in that article. I lost several subscribers too, by the way. It made a lot of people mad. I got a lot of hateful comments.
For
I think
being
I think
an optimist.
yeah I think I lost now 14 or 15 subscribers from that Trump article, but that's okay, because I gained about that much back,
Well, I
and
don't
sold a lot.
understand that, because if they read the article, it's consistent with your other analysis.
Well, some people are mad. Trump's pro-Israeli view makes a lot of people mad. Some people are mad that Trump, they're mad about the border issues, which, by the way, I've never been for open borders. I've never, ever supported the libertarian position on open borders. So I don't know why. Maybe people assume that I just had some kind of liberal view of something. I don't know. But and I'm not saying that the war on terror is true. Kellyanne Conway had a big gaffe today where she cited some terror event that never happened. So again, the decision, it's absurd to think that saying, okay, I might support this guy, that therefore means or carries with it the expectation that, like, you agree with everything. I mean, that's just childish and stupid. Nobody, you're not going to agree with anybody on everything. So
I don't agree with myself half the time. I'm having
and we
arguments with
change it.
myself all the time, like you
People
said.
change their mind, and I didn't really change my mind, because I had an optimistic view a long time ago about Trump. And but there were top people in Russia, philosophers, geopolitical strategists, who were studying Trump, and they came to the conclusion that it was his ideas were real, that he really represented some sort of opposition within the establishment, the deep state, and so forth. And so I'm not alone in this. You know what I mean? Like, all the think tanks think it's that they can't stand it. So that to me was, suggesting at least. And didn't he get rid of Victoria Nuland when she handed her papers and told the wall? Yeah. So I just don't. I mean, how is this? You ought to be happy that you're having a little bit of victory, even if Trump totally, like, turns and stabs everybody in the back tomorrow, and I don't know, like. Start some. Oh, and the other thing too that people are mad about, I keep getting this comment, that this is going to lead to World War III. Now, I'm not an expert on Iran or anything like that, but I'm sorry, I've been hearing about this World War III and war with Iran since I was a kid, and I've never seen a war with Iran. Okay, they don't have an army, like, they don't have, excuse me, they don't have a naval capacity that would compete with them. They're not going to go to war with America, I assure you. My dad went over there in the 80s under that Reagan Persian Gulf thing, and shot down their oil platforms, and there was nothing, right? Like, they're not going to go to war with America. And so all this stuff is just silly propaganda. And I'm very skeptical of mullahs and these characters. I'm not sure. I mean, I go back and read Khomeini in the 80s, and he was talking about how Iran was the enemy of Reagan, and they're going to destroy Ronald Reagan, and it's all a bunch of baloney. It's like nothing ever happened out of all that.
Yeah,
So,
it's like North Korea. It's a
yes.
boogeyman, a foil. It's they're, I think there are some questions regarding the genuineness of the revolution in 79. It's certainly served the interest of, I think we've talked about that, of
Yes.
the Rockefellers, and I think a lot of that was CIA taking using it to undermine the Carter administration because of his Saturday night. He tried to assert some measure of control of the CIA, and you get into Ted Shackley and his intrigues, and the foreknowledge of the embassy thing and how that was fomented, and the whole thing with the Shah and how that helped Chase Manhattan Bank. And then you had the 80s, the whole thing sheared down with Iran in the 80s served multiple political purposes. It also set up a situation they could drag out an 8-year war between Iran and Iraq, where just a lot of weapons were sold, made the area that much weaker. They, you know, 8-year war is going to prevent both countries from developing and becoming a strong nation. It makes it that much more easy for penetration and exploitation, which is both the Israeli and Anglo-American plan there. Weakening, you know.
Well, and there was also, there have been claims, at least by intelligence researchers, of covert support by the CIA and Mossad for Iran.
Oh, so, yeah. And Iran,
now, that may be true. Maybe disinfo. It may not be true. Lou Dobbs had a report of American and Russian scientists helping develop the so-called nuke program in Iran. So who knows what's true about any of this stuff?
Yeah, because if they help develop, then they can also upload the software, send in the software, like the Stuxnet stuff. Cyber war, right?
Good point.
Cyber war. The biggest cyber warriors are the CIA and NSA and intelligence, Western intelligence agencies. But again, all that it serves so many purposes, just to destabilize and create this arenas of constant conflict and war, which, if you listen to, you said you listen to the George Webb talk, and that serves a certain business model right there with human trafficking, drug trafficking, the exploitation of human misery, which is what this whole system, British East India system we're talking about, is all about, based on.
And might I also add that a lot of the characters who've been talking about the hyping up that kind of stuff have totally discredited themselves.
Yeah.
Tarpley's out there calling for signing up for Obamacare immediately. I mean, he's completely made it just ridiculous now. Like, the last tweet I saw from him was, hurry up and sign up for Obamacare before Trump, annihilates America.
Now, of course, you have to say that with Tarpley's voice. Come on.
This is the last chance. The women's march. This women's... I'm not joking, by the way.
Was he wearing a vagina? Was he wearing a vagina hat when he said it?
I was going to say this. That was like the most ridiculous thing I've ever seen from him. Was this women's march represents the New Deal today? Don't believe the reactionaries out of Washington and Trump. Disastrous decision by Putin to fall for the Trump deception. So yeah, in my mind, that guy's just completely discredited himself. So.
Two bags. I liked a book on terror.
Yeah, well, I was impressed with a lot of what he was saying. I never agreed with that older FDR style liberalism. You did get good critiques of deep state machinations and how terror operations work and that kind of stuff. And then
all the stuff you got to separate the wheat from the chaff, the good from the bad, and take it for what it's worth, and that's what you got to do in this. Now, do you have enough time? Do you want to talk about that on your article on your episode on Seraphim Rose?
Sure.
Because that was I think it's relevant, but explain Seraphim Rose and what was he all about? I know he grew up and he lived in California, so he was like at the epicenter of American Masonic, simulacrum, fantasy world stuff, Disney World and all that stuff. So,
I think for the Orthodox world in America, most people, a lot of people think that he will probably be America's next Orthodox saint. And, he, for a time, as I understand it, was living a very dissolute, homosexual lifestyle, actually. And, he got into the alternative movements out in California and was very into Eastern meditation and all this kind of stuff. And I guess he was like into the Zen type stuff.
So it was like Thomas Merton, that's everything.
And we know from, Dave McGowan's works and all of the stuff that John and Chris have talked about, you have all these alternative movements kind of popping up out there in California. And California was always kind of a mecca for quote alternative lifestyles. And so I'm not like an expert on Rose's personal life. There's a huge biography that Hiram Monk Damascene did, but I haven't read it. But he's an interesting character, and he had eventually a conversion to Orthodox Christianity, and then entered into monastic life, and then So he's kind of famous and known for certain works that he did, like he wrote a famous book on nihilism. And that book actually has converted a lot of people who were like atheists or in that kind of frame of mind. That's what that book's kind of known for, is converting atheists and nihilists. So he also wrote a very massive 700 or 800 page critique of Darwinism, which I'm a big fan of. I think it's pretty phenomenal, and I eventually intend to get to that, because he takes the approach that most people don't. He looks at it from a biblical and patristic perspective, and most people think that science is, that's like, there's no, you couldn't get further from science than the church fathers. Rose takes a very different approach, and so I appreciate him for that. I'm not saying he's right about everything. I've read his Augustine book and his Soul After Death book, and Soul After Death book, I take issue with. I think there's some questionable things there. But regardless, most people think Seraphim Rose, was a righteous, holy dude. So I never, I finally came across a hard copy of the book that he wrote in the 70s called Orthodoxy and the Religion of the Future. And this is where he treats of conspiracy theory, and he gets into the question of the UFO phenomenon and the deep state and the New World Order and the New Age movement and all this kind of stuff, and the exportation of Hinduism and ecumenism and so forth as a tactic. And like I said, in my talk, I gave the book 4 out of 5 stars. There's some areas where I think it could have been better, and maybe he didn't state things that well, and he could have been a little more skeptical of some of these deep state characters. But nevertheless,
But he's writing this in the 70s, though.
he was writing this in the 70s. Nobody else was doing that.
Well,
There, you
so
know.
then you got to cut him some slack there, Information just simply wasn't out there.
Right, but he was apparently, on to it enough that he foresaw. I mean, he was talking about the Illuminati in the 70s. It's very, I think we can appreciate that. And he foresaw a lot of what the ecumenical movement would do, that it would have the effect of diluting and destroying Christian communities. And so he says that about evangelical, Protestant, and Catholic churches as well. So he's not fair. He's not cruel to any other communities. And he predicted a lot of what would happen in the Orthodox world, in terms of what would happen with the American clergy and their acceptance of a lot of these doctrines. And he always opposed the. He's known, of course, for opposing the socialist and communist regimes in Russia and things like that. So, he's just a very fascinating character. There's not many people who had the kind of life that he lived. It's just very,
And
very unique.
he died very young, 48. So, yeah.
But so what I really appreciated was that it's not a difficult book. It's very, very simple, very accessible, but you have really good critiques of other worldviews like Hinduism, and how that's very close to ecumenism, and you get the ecumenical movement with this World Parliament Federation of Religions and Swami Vivekananda coming over in 1890s, and he believes he's commissioned by the Hindu gods to bring this new consciousness to the West, because the West had fallen into materialism and they needed to be saved by Hinduism, and that Hinduism would enlighten the West and all this kind of stuff. And so, if every 20-year-old girl does yoga now, and Seraphim Rose, he said that would happen in the 70s. He said you would see this, and he said this was coming. Now, obviously, there's not yet a global religion, but again, he's warning about that. And I appreciated that he has the quote from Jacques Vallée that the UFO phenomenon can be also engineered by the deep state, and I think that is what's happening. So that I wanted to hit on that point, And if you listen to the second half, if you're a subscriber to Jay's analysis, I found other quotes in other academic approaches to the UFO phenomena where the Brookings Institute says that the UFO phenomena could be engineered to discredit Christianity. And I think that was telling.
Yeah, and that follows along with the whole strategy or approach to this thing from the intelligence communities in exploiting or manipulating a culture's belief systems or fears, or you know the vampires in the Philippines, right?
Yeah, can I read this little quote here?
Sure.
This is from the Brookings Institute, Arthur C. Clarke, NASA. This is from The Lure of the Edge by Brenda Densler, Scientific Passions, Religious Belief, and the Pursuit of UFOs. And she's citing the, she says, Presbyterian minister Barry Downing suggested that this consistent refusal to admit that UFO reality and the discovery of ETs would have a profound impact on Christianity. And this was a way for liberal Christians to insulate themselves against the possibility of this happening. Fundamentalist Christians, however, did the same thing when they automatically attributed all of this phenomena to demons. In 1960, a Brookings Institute study commissioned by NASA stated that the effect of the discovery of ETs on fundamentalists of all religious traditions, notice that, would be electrifying. If it would have the potential far-reaching consequences, especially in societies where fundamentalists were a powerful social force. Sci-fi writer Arthur C. Clarke felt that the doctrine of the incarnation was a ticking time bomb if ETs were discovered, right? As one psychologist in the UFO community observed, perhaps in some ways the long battle against the UFO cover-up was not really about the public's right to know as much as it was about the public's right not to know. Not only would the idea of the incarnation itself come under revision and review, as one investigator pointed out, the whole Christian idea would be severely problematized. And then it goes on to cite the Brookings Institute report that the Christian religion would be particularly compromised by the discovery of extraterrestrial life, since it would mean that the incarnation, it was a historical event, and knowledge of the good news of Jesus and the ascension, the atonement, etc., was not available to the aliens. And then you'd have to figure out, did it reoccur on innumerable worlds, blah, 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 blah. So there you go. There's the deep state admitting that they could destroy Christianity. And that was actually one of the one of the theses that I put in my book. And I'd written that before I came across Brenda's book. So yeah.
And that you have also, I think it was the report from Iron Mountain suggested the threat of alien invasion using as an attempt to promote, to continue with the, I guess, with the war state, the military industrial complex, to collectivize the country, help organize and control society by fear. And you have, Ronald Reagan's statement in the 80s.
Right? Yeah, the UN, yeah.
Yeah, so these things. Not to mention this also coincides with the whole alien meme in the post-war era. All the movies, from the 60s.
Exactly.
And the high-budget movies, starting, well, you could say 2001. I don't know, that's technically not an alien movie. But the whole idea in the 70s, Close Encounters of the Third Kind.
Exactly.
E.T., right?
Even
the poster VT, right?
God and creation.
Right? Yeah.
But yeah, I've been rewatching Twilight Zone because Jay and I had discussed doing an episode of our potential show on Twilight Zone. So actually, I went ahead and just bought all the Twilight Zone on DVD. And is rewatching these early episodes, many of which are really, really good. You're getting a lot of this in the Twilight Zone too. And I brought this up many times, and they do talk about made in consultation with the department or the Pentagon or whatever, Department of Defense, or I can't remember what it is, but yeah, and but they're all talking about aliens and stuff in Twilight Zone. Interesting though, in this in this DVD set that I have, there was a public service announcement because they included some of like the older ads and stuff like that were run at the time. There was like a perfect public service announcement about going to church. Could you imagine something like that nowadays?
That is funny.
Just kind of blew me away how different the culture is. But
yeah, there was one I saw about protecting kids, about not being kidnapped by perverts in the park.
Mm-hmm.
And it shows the describing how the this man is a homosexual. This is how they he has been in the 50s, and they show up two boys playing basketball, and he starts playing basketball with the boys, and he convinces one of the other friends that they go home, and he stays with them, and then he ends up leaving with them in the car. And it's suggested he murders the boy,
you know. Wow.
But it's really dark. It's like really dark. It's like, geez, and explaining, you know, it's just very funny that the of the times, you know. It's
yeah,
you know, right. And it's way hokey, but you know, but whatever.
Yeah, but it's just amazing that you could have a public service announcement about something like that.
The church.
And how good it is to go to church.
Because communists don't go to church.
That's
fine.
Yeah.
Done spoken in those terms. You mentioned the kind of the promotion of mysticism in the East, and of course that picked up in the 60s with the Beatles.
Yes.
And the whole thing. But even before that, because I've heard a lot of it, the whole project with Huxley was sort of this, one of the reasons why they wanted to promote drug use, psychedelic drug use, navel gazing, this sort of stuff, was to kind of create in the West sort of a Hindu caste system.
Hmm.
And that's what they wanted, you know, because, you know, some people refer to it as neo-feudalism or something. That's what they're trying to create, you know, sort of
the whole
notion of Elysium and everyone else living on a degraded planet and all that stuff. But
right.
I just wonder if you found any connection with that, and maybe the Cliveden set picked up on it, and that's why Huxley was kind of promoting this Eastern mysticism, importing into the West to sort of impose on the West this caste system, which is... You know, which is a form of feudalism, I guess you could say.
But, I never thought about that. That's an interesting point, but it would certainly mesh well, you know, with the British Royal Society type perspective, and you know, the British Royal Society elites. Well, they certainly always had a fascination for their colony India, didn't they?
Yes.
So I would presume that all their studies and research that they did on their colony.
Yes.
I mean, you know, there's always been this very, very strange relationship between those two places.
I mean, you walk into that place, and how do they maintain control of hundreds of millions of these people? How do they do that? Well, the caste system, belief system, the Hindu belief system, right?
Yeah, and if they ever, whenever they rose up, Colonel Dyer murdered them all.
That's right.
In the rebellion. So I don't know if that was my relative, but I think we talked about that in the past. But
Ritsar, yeah.
Yeah.
But I guess they would have learned from administering the you know, that was a jewel in the crown for a century.
That's a great, great point. Yeah, amazing.
So that's interesting. I'm just wondering that, you know, that's where Huxley got that idea. You know, and then you hear it being imported into the West, you know, with that's all this, you know, everything that's exotic and different in the East is deep and mystical, and as if there's nothing to be gained from, you know, Christian philosophy or anything.
Exactly. And, one of the great points, too, that Father Rose points out that I've been arguing for a long time, and I'd read some chapters of this book a long time ago, 8 or 10 years ago, but I never got around to, you know, getting a hard copy and reading the full text, and so I was glad to see him, you know, back up a lot of the kind of arguments I've made, that one of the key problems with these Eastern, Far Eastern views is that they argue for the erasing of the individual. Okay. And so again, one of the great things about, I believe, about Christian philosophy and theology is that it believes in a balance of the one and the many. And mm-hmm. so, you know, you get this in the Trinitarian doctrine. You also get this in at least it's supposed to be in social theory as well, that we don't have, you know, the we're not supposed to have, at least in this metaphysic, the dominance of, you know, like Caesar, like smashing all the many. The one doesn't crush the many. The many mm-hmm. don't crush the one, right? So we don't want Caesar saying is God any more than we want you know, all the democratic masses rising up and thinking that they're God, you know, like Che Guevara says or something.
Yeah.
No, we don't want any of that because that's all dialectics. And so we don't believe in dialectics. But what he points out is that the Far Eastern perspectives, even though they realized the problems of dialectics, they sought to solve this dilemma through the negation of all particularities. And this is what Huxley talks about, and this is why I think you're right in your suspicion there about his view. Because Huxley says in the Perennial Philosophy that you know, the absolute that the global religion is going to promote is an impersonal absolute. And an impersonal absolute is good for smashing the masses because you crush their independent, you crush their reason and their existence as persons. And in Roman Catholic and in Orthodox theology, obviously, we don't believe in the negation and denial of the existence of the individual.
Yeah.
Like there's nothing in the mystical process, the spiritual process, or in theology, or this is why we're pro-life. Like you don't lose your identity. You don't meditate to try to become non-existent or something. Mm. You don't try to wipe out who you are, because who you are is part of, you know, God's gift to you.
Mm-hmm.
That's part of being made in the image of God, is being a unique individual. But you also are not only solely a unique individual who's atomized, right? So that's the dialectics again. But anyway, so Rose is right, I think, to criticize that Huxleyan view of using these Far Eastern philosophies as a way to beat down people in the West into losing their existence. And that's what it is, and make no mistake about it. Those people are that dastardly, him and Bertrand Russell and all those characters.
And the trick of identity politics that we're seeing today is that in this cult, this sort of narcissism, the cult of the self, you lose yourself. You know, it's almost like you deprive yourself of those institutions and those traditions. Those relationships, whether it's family and community, the real thing, and so you're left with nothing but you. You're an atomized individual with no sense of who you are, where you belong, and or a sense of like normal limitations, natural healthy limitations. Like I'm a boy, you're a girl, you know.
Yes.
You know, and now it's something as basic as that is now being questioned, and the language is being subverted to address this insanity. And the language loses its connection to reality. Language becomes psychological warfare. And you really do believe, you have people running around really thinking to themselves, not just because they want to appease the regime, people running around thinking 2 + 2 = 5, that a man can be a girl. This is insanity.
It is insanity. It's mental illness. And I think St. Anthony of the Desert said that. He said that one day you will see everyone running around mad and they will all think you're mad when you're the sane person. There's some famous quote of St. Anthony to that effect. But I made a comment on Facebook that this might have been what got me banned. I can't remember, but it was something that triggered the Zuckerberg algorithm to go into effect to ban me. But I said I was driving through a town and I saw. I'm not joking. I saw like 3 transgendered, fat, purple hair, blue haired things, and I was pointing out that aren't they unique individuals? Like all 3 of them were different people, but they all had blue hair and they were all overweight and they were all trans.
Mm-hmm.
So very unique individual snowflakes, aren't they? That's the thing, is that the cult of individuality is in our day it's a religious descent into madness. It really is. Mm-hmm. And
they're the ultimate subject for the New World Order, though.
Exactly. Exactly.
They have no concern for posterity. It's all about them. Me.
I remember when we were studying Marx in undergrad in my critical theory classes. I recall reading that Marx, like for a long time, I don't know if it's true, but the story is that he would go to the library and he would sit down in the library for like 12 hours a day. Mm-hmm. And he did this for a long time, just studying linguistics. And the reason he did this was that he felt that if you could master linguistics, that that was the key to changing the world. And I wonder if there isn't something to that, and that's why this assault on the language is so important for the globalists.
Well, there is a certain magic to language, and mm-hmm. and if you can through language change reality, you can say that's a form of magic, and that's what they're doing. When people can no longer, when they're trying to change pronouns.
Yes.
Create 30 different pronouns under the penalty of law, like in New York City. That's insanity.
Oh, there you go. Yeah. And it's hard to believe. It's like, you can't believe this stuff's happening. And hopefully this is where the globalists are overplaying their hand. But the discussion of 60 different genders in Germany, did you see that?
That's
what in the world?
I mean, did they never have that talk with your parents? Oh, they didn't have parents. You know,
yeah.
And that's where it all comes. That's what gets into this assault on family. Because I think Chris at HoaxPost made an interesting observation talking about the sexual revolution. And what happened there was the sexual revolution, you get all the promiscuity, you get the divorce and broken families. Okay. It's a generation or two after that you get all the sexual confusion, because it's the trauma that it's the descendants from these broken families that you get these people with sexual, confusion, because they've been traumatized. Yeah. You mentioned this alt-right character Milo,
mm-hmm.
and you made a point that he himself might be some sort of psyop, because where does he come from? Why is there so much attention to him? He's very articulate. Mm-hmm. He's got a British accent, so he sounds good, right? I mean, he always sounds good. That's one way the British conquer the world, just with their accent. I wish I could fake a British accent, but I do it. But
that's how I'm going to sell out. I'm going to have a gay British accent. Tomorrow.
But he himself is this flamboyant homosexual alt-right guy. That itself is a psyop. It's divide and conquer. But
well, of course, Tim, so am I. This is the new alt-right Jay, and we've got to stop these feminists, and they're just so prissy and ugly and disgusting out there. This is
See, if I could do that. Anyway, whatever. I was listening to his background, where he came from. And mm-hmm. apparently, if I understood, he admits to being abused, sexually abused as a child.
Yeah.
And his first consensual sexual experience was a threesome.
Mm-hmm.
I call that trauma.
Yeah, that's a great point from Chris, and I think this is one of the weak points of the libertarian philosophy, in my view, is that it has this tendency towards. Complete freedom in the social sphere, mm-hmm. but the problem is that the powerful players in the world know how to weaponize sexuality to destroy you.
Yeah.
So you can't. That's not enough. You know, you need more. You need a, in my view, holistic view of the human person. This mm-hmm. goes back to the point I was making about law being the grounding for freedom. And freedom only making sense if you have personhood. And
so as a practical matter, we need patriarchy. And I don't say that as I want to lord over my family. I say that because I have a responsibility to protect and provide for my family. It's the old servant leadership. And if you go for you just love your wife as Christ so loved the church, it's not to control her. If you figure what did Christ experience for his church? mm-hmm. Crucifixion, mm-hmm. So this is it's not to, as a practical matter, given the realities of human nature, in the main, men and society are much healthier. Society is much healthier if men lead families and they provide for their families, and from that they earn the respect of their spouse and their children. I know that it isn't perfect, but it's the reality we live in. It's the nature of things. It is in that environment that children are happier, and they have that moment of peace where they can develop. They have the age of discovery, where they're not subjected to all this crap. And all this toxic culture they're being subjected to is to destroy that, to deny them their innocence, so they become traumatized, so they're walking around town 40 pounds overweight with purple hair, not knowing what sex they are.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the goal.
Yeah, it's just very sad. And I mean, I didn't have a happy upbringing, so I kind of know. I know some of this firsthand. I'm not gay or anything, but I'm saying I know what it's like to to not have a father figure and that kind of stuff.
Yeah,
and
we're
I
all damaged goods. Yeah. We're all damaged.
Yeah, right.
But you know, we have to be mature enough to identify where we've been damaged. I mean, I point things I was exposed to as a youth.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just in my day, just pornography and stuff like that. You just couldn't get away from it in my youth. It became normalized in my youth. And I'm not going to say I was ever addicted to it, even enjoyed looking at it, but I was aware of it, and it does corrupt you. And the same thing with to me, there was always mom and dad in my family, and that was probably the best thing that my parents could ever do for me, because all the other problems in life you can handle usually, and if you're not given that family stability, I mean that does so much to a child.
Yes, and then you get the perpetuation of those problems compounded to the next generations, and so I think that's absolutely true. And then the devious globalists know this.
What gets me is that they're aware of it. They got it down to a science.
Exactly.
Where they fine tune the entertainment, the culture, even the food we're eating.
Yeah, and it's not you say all these communists are out there to destroy the family. Well, okay, but. Bertrand Russell was who was saying that we've got to destroy the family in the West for the technocratic era. So he's absolutely lock, stock, and barrel with Marx and the communists. So, yeah, all these Fabians, all these Marxists, all these characters.
But again, to end it on a sort of a positive note is that somehow, in some weird, mysterious way, perhaps the election of Donald Trump is a reaction to this. And at the very least, it's provided it's a reaction to political correctness, so it gives us the ability to, the freedom to articulate and fight back a little bit, you know. How it ends, right. I don't know, you know, so.
Agreed.
You know, so, anything else? I mean, I've had you for 2 hours now.
No, I think that's all I've got for tonight.
Well, listen, I know you've been talking a lot today, so I really want to thank you for spending so much time with me. Tonight.
Sure.
It's great. That's Jay Dyer, Jay's Analysis. Of course, his book is Esoteric Hollywood, Sex, Cults, and Symbols in Film. Go to his website, check out his work. Of course, you can support him by being for $4.95 a month, $60 a year, to support his research or buy his book. And he'll produce more material, and we can all be richer for it. So there you go.
Thank you. Yep.
So,
I think... going to try to do get back to some of the philosophy. We may do Marcus Aurelius's Meditations next, I think is the next thing I'm going to do. So
you mentioned you might do something on Program to Kill.
Yeah, I keep forgetting to get back to that. Thank you for reminding me. Yeah.
Okay, because that's one of the more creepier, fascinating aspects of that. So, okay. Well, listen, Jay, I'll let you go tonight. Thanks a lot.
Okay.
It's great.
All right, thank you. Have a good night, Tim.
Good night, and I'll post this when I do. I will send you the link.
All right, thanks.
All right, take care. Bye-bye.